Hi, Bob.
Hi, Brian.
Welcome to Blogging Heads.
Well, I think I'm happy to be here. We'll see.
Well, I'm happy to have you here. This is sort of an experiment because the high tone discussion on this site is usually devoted to the Iraq War and immigration and the national economy. But today, you and I are going to attempt to do one of these things on sports.
Well, no, let's not devalue our discussion. I'm not so sure that all of it doesn't start in some sense right here. I think the perverted values that kids learn in youth sports really go right on to Congress and Enron, and there's a clear line between the field house and the White House, I've always thought.
that's a very good phrase. Okay, we will not limit it, but we will say that we are starting anyway with sports and moving on into the broader world from there. How's that?
Okay.
Some introductions. You are Robert Lipsight. You're a former columnist, sports columnist at the New York Times, the author of numerous books, including Sports World, which is one of my favorites, and most recently Raiders Knights. Raiders Knight or Raiders Knights?
Raiders Knight.
Raiders Knight.
It's a young adult novel about the dark side of high school football.
Excellent. And I'm Brian Curtis, and I'm a contributing writer to Play, which is the New York Times sports magazine. So the first thing, Bob, I wanted to ask you about today is baseball on steroids, since it's that time of year.
I think that's a marriage made in heaven. I never understood how you could go up the Pyrenees without hard drugs. And I also don't think it's possible to go up against a fastball or throw one consistently without hard drugs. I'm all for it.
You're all for the combination.
Absolutely. I think the genie has been out of the bottle for so long that anything... I think that what bothers me is that this discussion seems to be an ethical discussion rather than a scientific discussion. I think what we don't know is what this stuff does. For how long does it do it? And what are the long-term effects? It has not been really good, hard science. And I think that part of the reason is that baseball itself, and when I say baseball itself, I can't talk for anybody except a good friend who happens to be an owner, not in New York. and I really kind of have gleaned that it's a don't ask, don't tell attitude. They're very happy because baseball has been very, very good to them in recent years.
Sure.
And their only real concern is about recreational drugs, that the guys will go back into 70s mode and start using cocaine and things that would affect performance negatively. They don't care. I don't care. Fans don't care. Some sports writers care because they don't have much to write about. My only concern, and I'm about to end my rant, is that kids whose bones are still coming together, who are neurologically still in the process of becoming, are taking stuff that can do long-term damage. But, when we're talking about some narcissistic 35-year-old guy desperate to stay in the show, it's his body.
Mm-hmm. And is it, I completely agree with you in terms of the science being an incredibly murky. We're in this period. I mean, if you read, God bless you, if you did the Mitchell Report, the scientific aspects of it were very, very shaky. We're talking about steroids on the one hand, and also human growth hormone on the other. And there is
And don't forget the fact that these are very rich guys who can afford really good doctors and chemists. So I think we're beyond HGH into boutique drugs that have been really carefully created for specific needs. Look, right now, they are busting high school kids all over the country with their chemistry sets in their parents' basement, cutting powdered drugs from China into liquid steroids for injection. So if these non-Westinghouse winners in high school are doing it all over the country, can you imagine what a good, smart scientist is doing for an athlete, probably without even thinking that what he's doing is criminal.
Mm-hmm. And do you, I mean, 4 months after the Mitchell report, did that in your mind accomplish anything at all?
Yes. I thought the Mitchell report was a brilliant piece of spin. What it did was create the idea that we are now in the post-steroids era. They didn't mean HGH, but that we have now done this thing. We've named these, what were these 89 fringe ball players or people who were not active anymore, most of them. And now we can move on into a juice-free future.
Right. So essentially the document allowed baseball to sort of seemingly wash his hands of the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it was a very clever move, and it kind of forestalled anything else of a substantive nature.
In terms of, I mean, but surely the sports writers, the ones who were so hard after these guys, are going to be hard after these guys in the future, right? In terms of finding out whether they're...
Sports writers, I almost feel sorry for the hacks.
How so?
If you want to look for real complicity, it was the mainstream sports writers. It's not as if they didn't know. I mean, first of all, if they were, as they tend to front themselves, insiders, locker room guys, good sources, they had to know that a lot of guys were using drugs.
Sure.
Even if they didn't, once some of the early stories in 96, 97, 98 were out, general managers were talking about it. The Andro was seen in McGuire's locker. Remember,
right.
when that AP guy saw the Andro in McGuire's locker, it should have caused kind of a steroid-feeding frenzy. All these great investigators should have moved in and gotten the story. But no, they called him a snoop for looking in McGuire's locker. They wanted this glorious summer of SWAT. They wanted baseball, our game that we write about, to bind the wounds of a country damaged by Clinton and Lewinsky. That other famous battery. They never went on. I mean, you've got these sports writers now, beating their chests, righteous. I mean, I think I read Mike Lupica, other than pimping for Imus, he tends to be harmless. But his kind of righteousness about all this doesn't really reflect well against the elegiac columns and book he wrote in 98 about this glorious summer.
I was going to say, he had a book contract hinging on the summer of 98 going according to the script.
I mean, right? I don't think he was writing about the summer of steroids.
I mean, and that is part of the problem when we talk about the sports media, right, if we can generalize here, is that there is this adherence to the, in 98, the adherence was to the storyline that baseball was back, that, we had entered this, after the strike in 94, baseball had sort of finally climbed back into this, sort of esteemed position in American life, and they were sort of sticking to that story whether or not it was actually true, and however or not, baseball had managed to climb back there, and now that, we're in the sort of Mitchell report era, they stick to that, as you say, whether or not, true there is.
Baseball writers, and maybe sports writers in general, tend to be lovers. They tend to be besotted with the subject. They are very often in denial about the dark side of it. Also, it's to their advantage as careerists not to lose access and to paint the rosy picture that the fans want to read. I have this terrible image at your paper. I have this terrible image of Murray Chass, the great baseball writer of the Times, on one side, not seeing steroids, and next to him, Judith Miller, seeing the weapons of mass destruction.
Oh, my goodness.
Both of them, with this marvelous tunnel vision, moving on and leading us into very false premises. I think sports writers have tended to do us a great disservice in not deciding who and what they are. Are they there to extend the joy of the entertainment? Fine, you know, be like a food writer or a gossip writer. Are they investigative reporters? Well, there are a few of them that are and have done well. Then dig out the information. Are they just, bloviators telling us we don't need them anymore because we've got the internet for that?
I mean, this is essentially the paradox or whatever you want to, or the tension in sports writing since the very beginning, right? Are you essentially providing free advertising? Isn't from the early days? Are you providing free advertising for the event, or are you treating it like a legitimate beat? I mean,
I don't think that really became a conscious concept until the 60s.
Okay. I agree there, but...
Yeah, I think that, for most of the previous century, there was a real community of interest in every way. I mean, sports writers traveled with the teams. The disparity in income wasn't that great. They were mostly the same color and sex. They were the same guys. One had better motor skills than the other, and one may have been able to write better than the other. Things really split in the 60s. And part of it was the beginning of professionalization of sports writing. And sports writers, we began to think that we were really journalists. What a mistake. And I think that lasted only so long. And now it's this kind of, as you talk about it, there's this very difficult paradox. Sometimes the conflict operates in the same guy, in the same day, in the same story of how to handle this fact of looking down at a game and wanting to describe it, wanting to extend the fans' pleasure in it, but also kind of knowing what's really going on.
Right. I don't spend much time in locker rooms, thank goodness, these days. But it would seem to me that it's just harder to get. It's harder for them, for the sports writer to have any time with the athlete, maybe in comparison to when you, are writing in your first stint with the Times, to just spend any time with the athlete anyway. The guys are protected by legions of publicists and
I remember the second or third Super Bowl I went to, which was the Jets Colts 69, and the big problem in getting access to Joe Namath on a daily basis was that there were so many kids and little old ladies who were also crowding around him at the hotel pool. This sounds bizarre now. How many layers would you have to go through to talk to a quarterback?
So let me ask you another question that sort of deals with sports writing in a sense, and also with baseball and steroids. One of the things that's been pointed out is a potential sort of discrepancy between the coverage of two guys. One of them is Roger Clemens, who is one of the greatest, statistically speaking, one of the greatest pitchers in baseball history. Played most recently with the Yankees. The other guy is Barry Bonds, who last season broke Hank Aaron's long-standing home run record. Clemens was, until the Mitchell report and the sort of more recent revelations, portrayed by sports writers as a guy who, sort of was a great pitcher well into old age because he worked so hard. Whereas, Bonds, and if there was any wonderings about if and when he used performance-enhancing drugs, those were pretty buried. With Bonds, it was sort of the opposite. You read, in the paper pretty frequently about, Barry Bonds' hat size expanding and all kind, his body changing and all these kinds of things. Did you sort of perceive a disparity in the coverage of those two?
Yeah, and I think although race did figure, I think, I wouldn't totally discount that. As some people have, I think it was only part of the picture. There are a couple of other things. First of all, the media was not afraid of Barry Bonds. You know, San Francisco, kind of a jerk. He can't hurt you. They were afraid of Clemens, not only, you know, his intimidating presence, you know, but he really seemed tied in to the baseball jockocracy. And, you know, you could lose access for roughing him up. Also, we had been anesthetized to this whole issue by Bonds by the time we got to Roger. And then there was something else. Nobody liked Barry Bonds. I will not bore you with mine, but every sports writer who's ever been, you know, in a locker room has a story of being treated badly by Barry Bonds.
But now I want to hear your story. Please do. Please tell. Can you share it?
Yeah, but I mean, it's totally banal. I was doing a piece, the most benign, silly piece you... Not silly, but the most benign piece you can imagine about the San Francisco Giants campaign as a team for pediatric AIDS. This was the first team. This was the first team that ever did anything around AIDS at all. It was a very big deal, and most of it was pediatric AIDS because they, you know, most of the players didn't want to take that next step. But it was really a very, you know, admirable AIDS campaign, and they kind of like lined up to give me quotes. Dusty Baker, the whole team. The only one who didn't was, of course, Barry. And I really kind of wanted him. I kind of needed him. And I kept going to him, you know, later. Can't talk to you now. Turned his back. And this went on for a couple of hours until, you know, my time was kind of coming to an end. And finally, I went to his dad, Bobby Bonds, whom I had known from the Yankees. And I said, listen, I'm on a deadline. Can you help me out? I really need to talk to him. And he looked at me and he said, well, you know, all kindness, he said, I'm sorry, I can't help you out. He's always been a jerk and he gives me a hard time too. So, but...
Bobby Bonds couldn't even get a quote from Barry Bonds.
I was writing a column, I didn't have to go back. You know, there was no real pressure, ultimately. But you can see that if he was really kind of part of your story, if you were covering the Giants or the National League or whatever, you could really not like him in a major way. And it would be hard to really empathize with what he went through. Here is arguably the best player of his time. You may be a Ken Griffey fan, but arguably the best player of his time.
I agree.
Pre-chemicals, suddenly looking around, and here are these two, you know, bloated meatballs, McGuire and Sosa, who really can't carry his bat, getting all the attention, all the love and admiration that he so desperately wanted. Here is this black prince of baseball, right? You know, son of an all-star, godson of a god, Willie Mays, the heir apparent to, you know, the love of the national pastime. And he's, you know, being dismissed, you know, by these clowns, white clown, tan clown, you know, jolly boys, who are not really such jolly boys. And you can see that he wanted a piece of that, too. And he went and did what any ambitious athlete will do in this time. He will get a little help.
Right. Allegedly, we should say, allegedly
he went and got a little help.
Allegedly went until the conclusion of court proceedings. Let me turn toward another topic here, which has been a particular interest to me lately, which is the NFL. We're recording this a couple of days before the NFL draft, but I guess what's interested me about the NFL is the big story in that league in the last couple of years has been discipline, quote unquote. And this sort of idea that the commissioner, Roger Goodell, is going to be laying down the law to ball players who, you know, sort of commit, you know, sort of charged with a crime or commit a crime off the field. I mean, There's a couple interesting things to talk about. One is that I think you once described the NFL as being run by middle managers, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Goodell strikes me as the ultimate middle manager now, who's now
but
running.
Smart.
Who's now, but smart, right?
Yeah.
I mean, do you actually think, I mean, I sort of think what you said about steroids when you say that it doesn't decrease the public's interest in the game. Does the idea that, you know, your running back might have been involved in some altercation in the offseason decrease anyone's, you know, enjoyment of the NFL?
No.
And is that,
in fact
what drives Goodell to do?
No, in fact, depending on the felony, it could increase your interest. I mean, now, Michael Vick and dogs, you know, forget about it. We love dogs. we care about that. But had Michael Vick, you know, beat up his girlfriend, well...
He'd most likely be playing right now.
Hey, you know, strong men have strong appetites. And in a way... You know, and now let's get into conspiracy theory. Anyway, I think that this perceived crackdown on off-field misbehavior is a kind of Mitchell Report smokescreen also about steroids. I think the National Football League is one big vat of steaming chemicals. I think it's impossible to have these incredibly talented, incredibly fast, skilled, you know, 900-pound gorillas moving the way they do, you know, without some serious drugs. I can't tell you how shameful I feel telling you this, but in the late 60s and early 70s, I remember going into pro football locker rooms and noticing these splashes of acne across the back and shoulders, particularly linemen, as it was called. And I would look at it and I would say, I guess the new equipment really chafes. boy, what a naive dummy I was. I mean, that was the beginning, you know, of use. I think there's a tremendous amount of use there. I think it's totally out of control. I think that it's very sophisticated drug usage, which may not be showing up at all. And I think that it's very important for this image of control that the NFL posture about how tough it is on these guys who act badly. Because also, subliminally, gives the fan the idea that they're also cracking down on drug use as well.
That's sort of an interesting point. I mean, I certainly agree the NFL is ultimately all about control, right? And controlling it's been very good at controlling its image. I mean, if we stipulate for the moment that, you know, players in the NFL, possibly numerous players in the NFL, are using some kind of illegal drugs, then I think only someone living in a fairy tale world would probably think that no one in the NFL is doing such a thing. It just doesn't show up, and you're saying it's so sophisticated that it just doesn't show up.
Yeah, I think it's sophisticated, or there may be mechanisms by which they get enough notice. Look, the point is that I don't think that any other sport uses drugs as much as the NFL does. First of all, I think we all understand, we talk to athletes enough, for them to realize that nobody is really thinking that that they're deciding to make an unethical decision or doing something criminal. Nobody really thinks there's anything wrong in taking steroids. No athlete thinks that it's wrong. They see it as a kind of medicine. It enables them, I mean, you know.
Part and parcel of the other things they're injected with.
I'm a steroid user, Brian. 17 years ago, after a third cancer operation, my body stopped making testosterone, and I've been having to shoot myself ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know a lot about steroid use. And I have to tell you that in 17 years of using this stuff, my hand-eye coordination has not improved. I still can't hit a curveball. and also my fastball has lost, you know, 25 miles an hour. So your point is, you have to
you're
be
not,
a genetic.
You're not touching high 90s like you used to. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to be a genetic freak in the first place. You have to be a star or a superstar for this stuff to make you a superstar or a monster.
Right.
So,
and then at the lower level, if you're, you know, maybe a marginal major leaguer,
these guys know this. They also come out of a culture where, since high school, they've been sent in hurt with painkillers. Team doctors have always given them drugs which they didn't necessarily understand. They've done all sorts of things under medical supervision that was not necessarily in their best interests, so that they could play. This, you know, doing it themselves, but very often, I suspect, with a trainer's complicity and kind of the owner winking, is merely an extension, you know, of all that cortisone, of all those painkillers, of all those shots that they've taken, and all those concussions, and all the arthritis medication that they will take for the rest of their lives.
Let me direct you to something that I think is also sort of piqued your interest, which is we're sort of in the midst, as we record this, of college basketball players declaring for the NBA draft, I should say. There's this rule that was enacted in college basketball recently that instead of jumping from high school directly into the pros, which so many players like Kevin Garnett had been able to do, that you now had to go play 1 year of college basketball, or I think at least had to be 1 year removed from high school in order to be drafted into the pros. And this week the last couple weeks we've seen players like Michael Beasley, who's from Kansas State, who played 1 year there, sort of declaring for the NFL draft. Now, I'm the NBA draft, excuse me. Now, it's a lot of people purely from the sort of sporting perspective have said this is a great deal because these guys play sort of 1 year of high school, 1 year of college basketball, and, you know, and whoever's a fan of the NCAA tournament gets to see them rather than seeing them on some, you know, on some grainy high school video. What is your take on the system?
Well, I think it's a good thing for both the NBA and the NCAA. The NCAA, you know, gets these stars for at least a year. The NBA gets children who have just a little more fundamental seasoning. And it seems to me really interesting that so soon after this rule is enacted, there's a kind of merger between the NCAA and the NBA. It was announced at the end of the Final Four. Their scheme is to, and the details were totally vague. It was just kind of this outline of, you know, we'll invade and we'll be cheered as liberator kind of thing. We don't know how we're going to occupy the country after we get there. But the idea was that the NCAA and the NBA would control youth basketball. Youth basketball is now kind of a chaotic thing, basically controlled in pieces by the AAU, which is a shoe company conceit
right
now.
By street agents,
by high school federations, which can't get it together to create a national tournament. But now suddenly, the really big money, one of the richest and smartest globalized corporations in the world, the NBA, and this consortium, non-profit consortium of college athletic departments, which is the NCAA, are coming together to extend the pipeline downward, probably down to middle school, elementary school. You know, if you're thinking of conceiving a child, you might you want to register the kid now.
No time like the present, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a reaction to youth basketball, what we used to know as youth basketball, becoming such a commodity, right? I mean, no one, you know, in 20 years ago, you wouldn't have ever thought there was any value, right, in thinking about 13, 14-year-olds playing basketball, right? But
well,
now we've had a decade of 18-year-olds.
A couple of decades ago, there may have been a great value and kids playing basketball. Back at the time, that we still tended to believe that sports created character and self-esteem.
Right. I mean, value,
collect moral play.
Right.
But we weren't thinking
about
it.
But not a monetary value.
We weren't thinking of it as a developmental league.
Right.
Which is what it's now.
I mean, is it in some sense that the NBA wants to have the kind of relationship? I mean, one of the things about that the NFL has profited from greatly is this rule that to play the pro football, you have to spend 3 years at least in college. And the NCAA football effectively becomes a full-scale developmental league for the NFL, where the players, by the time they get out, are more or less ready to play professional football. You know, mm-hmm. they've physically developed a lot since their high school years. They've been in college for a period, so, you know, presumably they've, you know, learned different things there and all those kinds of fundamentals and all that stuff. And with the NBA, there's been less, fair enough to say until this point, less control because, the player either comes out of high school or he comes out at some random point, you know, in his college career, right? And they want to sort of institutionalize that relationship a little bit more. Is that fair enough?
Well, yeah, but I mean... there have been enough Kobe's and LeBron's and lesser players that it works. You don't have to go to college.
Right. I agree.
Right? Right. You don't have to go to college. I think the games are that much different. I think that the maturation process, the physical maturation process, may be different. One ball player can really... totally change a team far more readily in basketball than in football. So the system kind of works. I think that the new rule, which is, I guess, is fine. I really have no strong feelings about it, is really to the advantage of both leagues. Because, I mean, a lot of kind of immature guys have been getting into the NBA. You know, it was kind of wine before its time.
Right.
And a year not only will mature their skill sets, but maybe will socialize them a little bit more.
I think that's big.
Also kind of prepare the audience for this kid. I mean, how exciting to see, the star of tomorrow today. I mean,
that's big.
You see him
in the NCAA tournament.
You see him in the Final Four, and you know that next year they're going to see him on the Mavericks.
I mean, that's absolutely right. I mean, I think, especially this year's NCAA tournament was, basically, up to and including the Final Four, was a showcase for guys who are going to be in the NBA next year.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And Derrick Rose from Memphis and Kevin Love from UCLA and then guys like Michael Beasley in the earlier rounds.
And even if it's only 1 year in college, it already creates this sentimentalized feeling, while they're struggling in the NBA. Oh, we knew them when they were just kids.
right. The sort of ownership and
college boys.
Yeah.
Exactly. Fighting for old U State.
it is amazing what only 1 year of wearing a sort of college logo will do for a player's image. Like you said, he battled bravely for old alma mater, so he must be okay. The last thing I want to touch with you on is the Olympics. It's 4 years again, only a couple months away, and I guess the big news in the papers recently has been in this hilarious ritual of carrying the torch around the world in advance of the Olympics. The torch has been, I don't say attacked, but they've been attempting to wrest the torch away from the guys running down the streets in London and San Francisco and those things. Have you been following this?
Take it to Tibet.
Right.
I only think about the Olympics every 4 years. What about you?
They're correct, yes. Sometimes I try not to even think about it then. I mean, were you at the 68 Olympics?
I was, and I blew that story, I must tell you.
I mean, that's interesting, 40 years ago this year, right?
Yeah, the day before the Olympics began, a Mexican tour guide on her day off took me to the plaza where the students had been machine gunned as part of the Olympic cleanup and showed me the brownish stains on the cobblestones. And, I had no reason to disbelieve her. But I was a very proper New York Times reporter, and I hadn't been in the New York Times, on the AP wire or on any kind of mainstream thing. So it was hard for me to understand that even such a thing could happen, even in Mexico, even with a country trying so desperately to provide a tourist face to the world. But then, then you go back, and it goes back even further than the Nazi Olympics. The guy who kind of restarted the Olympics, this, saintly Baron Kuppertown. He rebooted it because they had lost the Franco-Prussian War, and he wanted to get French kids in shape.
Right.
And I think early on he wanted to keep Germans and women out. But it's always been intensely politicized.
Right.
And either the country was using it as a showcase, its enemies were trying to discredit it, other countries were trying to come in and get on the scoreboard, or in the most grotesque happening, a terrorist organization tried to, without a team, set a team of terrorists to put themselves in 72 on the scoreboard. So, it's hard to see the Olympics from a distance in any way, but that way. On the other hand, and of course now the athletes are making a lot of money from the Olympics. There are all these, $50,000, from the Federation for a gold medal.
Sure.
But, these people really try, work very hard for that one shot. So, I have, really mixed feelings about any kind of boycotting or protest or disruption. It's a great spectacle. I think it's a wonderful show. And I think if we can kind of, keep it, in that box, and not think of it as any kind of national virtue for us or them. We can find some sport that we enjoy and follow it. Otherwise, it's really been so devalued, I think, over the years, with so many other spectacular sports emerging, while it has lost whatever patina that it has had of internationalism and fellowship, that the Olympics is just another big NASCAR race to me, and I love NASCAR.
Well, I think that's exactly right. And some of it just feels, I personally boycott the opening ceremonies just because I can't stand to watch them anymore. The sort of hours and parades of nations of all, a couple of NBC announcers make, jokes and light banter through the whole thing. To take the 68 Olympics one more time with John Carlos and Tommy Smythe, I was thinking about athletes and political activism recently. Is there, to your mind, when we say that athletes are, it's very rare to see an athlete who makes, who goes very far to make any kind of political statement these days. Is that just the obvious reasons, they don't want to, disrupt their Nike shoe contract or something like that? Are there other factors there that, beyond what you would sort of think?
I think there are a lot of factors, Brian, and although not wanting to disrupt your Nike shoe contract seems totally justified to me.
right. It's a lot of money.
I think there's an enormous amount of ferment in the culture in 1968. Athletes tend to come to these things a little later. They've been channeled, they've been controlled. Athletes, I think athletes are at least as smart as everybody else. And most of them, I think, are smarter than everyday people. But they tend to be ignorant because they have been so channeled and so focused and directed since you're 10 years old and haven't even had to take out the garbage, you know, much less think about current events and perform for your family, your community, your team, and the enormous responsibilities that go with it.
Sure.
So, I mean, first of all, unless there's an enormous surge of activism in their community, college, high school, you know, wherever they are, it's certainly not going to happen on its own. Now, in 68, there was.
Right.
And Carlos and Smith came out of real activism. Harry Edwards, their sociology professor at San Jose State, was the architect of that Olympic boycott. Jack Scott, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar did not go to those Olympics in his protest. So there was a lot of, you know, serious protest involved with that and with the stripping of Muhammad Ali's title. Now, what happened was the establishment crushed everybody. You know, Smith and Carlos did not reemerge for years. And I was thinking, I had been very close to the protest movement in 67, 68, and I was kind of faintly disappointed at the Black Power salute. It was actually the mildest display of that year. You know,
you're saying paling in comparison to what you'd seen outside of the...
Absolutely, and even paling in comparison to what the plans had been. They were going to take their shoes off, of course. The whole Adidas Puma thing was starting to happen then, and so nobody was going to mess with shoes too much. But so Smith and Carlos were wiped out. Ali's three best fighting years were wiped away. He never really recovered in a corporate way. It became very clear that any athlete who protested, you know, would be shut down.
Right.
And they were. And so all that energy, you know, all that sense of self went into, you know, personal promotion. And the line ultimately became Michael Jordan. And Michael Jordan, who was criticized for, you know, not being an activist, but
right.
what exactly was he going to be an activist about, other than, you know,
shoe
contract. I mean, the greatest piece of activism that we saw was really by Michael Jordan in the 92 Olympics, the Dream Team, when he took the American flag, and this I thought was the ultimate ironic, iconic gesture. He took the American flag on the, when he got to the medal ceremony,
right,
and he wrapped it around himself to cover up the Reebok logo.
That's right.
He was Nike guy. Right.
That he was forced to wear. That's right.
Right. So so that was the end. You know, there's part of me that doesn't really want athletes to become political and to demonstrate. One, because most of them are right wingers. and two,
well, maybe on the professional golf tour, yeah.
And two, because most of them really don't know that much. As I said, not because they're stupid, but because they've been really busy.
Right.
And so I would rather wait until they were in their 30s and 40s when they knew something before they start marching.
Right. And by then the Nike contract will have lapsed and we can...
Right.
There'll be less
unless
they know it anyway.
Senior shoes. That would be the next thing. Keep them quiet.
Well, Bob, this has been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. What great fun.
What great fun. And hopefully we'll meet again and you know, do our own sort of version of sports radio here one more time.
Anytime.
All right. Take care.